It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And it's a big thumbs up from Maria. And we're happy to have you back, too.
Meanwhile, I'm dipping my thumbs.
John almost spilled his drink over here.
All right, and for those listening,
if you see sparks and shorting out equipment over here, you'll understand what that is. It's a gorgeous day outside, by the way. If anybody's lying in bed, get out of bed. It's sunny. It's warm.
It's springtime.
You'll have 3 days like this for the rest of the calendar year, so you might as well enjoy one.
That's right.
Right. We're always here to bring the good news, you know?
That's right.
Put a positive spin on everything.
And, of course, springtime naturally means to governors it's time to veto things, right?
It's time to take away our electoral rights, something like that.
That's right. Why don't you go ahead, John?
No, go for it.
Yeah, this week Gary Locke made the decision to veto a portion of the bill that was passed in the legislature this spring, this March. For the new primary system. Now, folks might remember that our original blanket primary system was challenged in court by the Democrats and Republicans and the Libertarian Party as not allowing them to select their own representatives for the final election. Now, the court overturned the blanket primary system, so the legislature had to come up with a new primary system. And what passed through the legislature was a strange bill that allowed for a top two primary system, which pretty closely resembles our blanket primary. It means that the top two vote getters for each office would then advance to the final election, regardless of which party. So, for example, in a heavily Democratic district, you could have two Democrats advance to the final election and no Republican.
But now, that's not the only reason it was a strange bill, though.
That's right. Now, the other half of that bill was it foresaw that Governor Gary Locke might veto this bill because, of course, the Democrats and the Republicans complained that, well, this top two system, which is often called the Cajun primary.
Louisiana.
Because it's modeled after the Louisiana primary. Now, this top two system still doesn't allow, you know, Democrats and Republicans to really choose their own person to move on to the final election. They were saying that, well, if this passes, we'll challenge it in court just like we challenged the blanket primary. And so Governor Gary Locke was saying he was thinking that he might veto that bill if it passed. So people in the legislature tacked on a second half to that bill saying that if Governor Locke vetoes the top two system, then we would default to something called a Montana primary. Do you want to describe that, Jav?
Well, I was going to say that with the legislature, this was a very specific strategy by legislators to be able to appease the public, but also anticipate what the political parties wanted, because the public really wanted, you know, was that the public really wanted something as close as possible to the blanket primary, which is what they passed. But understanding that this is something that Gary Locke would veto, and that the political parties, which, you know, all of these folks are obviously members of, didn't want that. So the assumption really was that they were going to wind up with exactly what Gary Locke left us with. But they could go back to voters and say, well, we passed this other thing. It was Gary Locke's fault. And now Gary Locke's not running for re-election, so nobody's to blame for this.
That's right. And the system that's going to be in place if this veto stand holds up is based on the Montana primary, where folks could go into a primary and you'd have to choose which ballot you want to vote, either a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian Party ballot or whatever. You'd be given that ballot and only be allowed to choose the candidates from one party or another. But you would not be forced then to register as a Democrat or a Republican. Now, there's some question as to whether the veto will actually hold up, because supporters of the top two system have threatened to take it to court, because there's some question as to whether a partial veto, vetoing only part of a bill, is actually legal under the Washington Constitution.
Yeah, there's really no precedent for having this type of a bill that makes a specific provision saying, well, we'll do this if there's a veto for the for another part of the bill. I mean, basically the way the bill was constructed was it passed two bills. It passed one bill saying this is what our law is going to be, but oh, if the governor vetoes this, then we're passing this other bill. But they put it in the same package, and there's a real question as to whether that's legal or not.
Right, and another reason they did it too is because they needed something in place for the upcoming primary this year. Otherwise, we'd end up with a situation like you had in California with the governor, with the governor's race, with 1,000 candidates on the ballot.
Yeah.
And that could turn out to be a real mess.
Or they would have to call a special session of the legislature, which nobody wanted.
Right, right.
All right. Well, moving along, it looks like Seattle is getting another coalition together. We don't have nearly enough.
we actually have one at a time because they all fall apart. But this is somewhat encouraging, and we'll see where it goes. But there's beginning to be monthly meetings now of something called the Seattle Progressive Electoral Coalition. And this happened again Thursday night. It's a group of people from the Kucinich and Dean campaigns that have been relatively newly energized and organized, along with Greens and Progressive Democrats and some other folks that are trying to pull together a coalition that can not only support progressive electoral candidates locally and I would imagine nationally as well. They're trying to drum up support and register people to vote in the presidential race this year, but also to groom candidates for races such as, we had the candidates for the school board this past year and for city council for next year's races and for other local and regional races as well. We'll see whether it happens. I mean, your introduction really pretty much summarizes the hazard for all of this, which is that we've seen coalitions of this type, not specifically electoral political coalitions, but just efforts in general to have, why don't all of the different progressives who are working on all the different issues in Seattle all get together in one big group? I mean, you hear this all the time. Usually from people who haven't been in progressive politics for very long and haven't seen how difficult it is for some of these people to work together. But it is encouraging to see that that people are trying to work together, that there is a lot of new energy specifically around people being energized with the presidential race this year. Mm-hmm. And, people are hopeful that it'll work out. It's first Thursday of each month, meeting at the Labor Temple. So if you want to get something circled in your calendar for May, there it is, and show up. And if you want to get involved, go for it.
All right, moving along. This week in Iraq.
Iraq.
Figured you might have missed me last week, so
we did.
I have a lot.
You had to put up with me giving this week in Iraq, and that was a disaster.
Excuse me. Well, this week we have a little update on the whole weapons of mass destruction thing, particularly the mobile bioweapons labs. Now, that was a cornerstone of Colin Powell's presentation to the UN before the war, was that he threw up these big diagrams to show everybody that Saddam Hussein had developed this whole program of mobile bioweapons labs to make anthrax and botulinum toxin and all these other big bad weapons that could be used on against the Iraqi people and supposedly against the rest of the world. Now, it turns out that that information came from one Iraqi defector who has been called a complete fabricator. Now, he was directed to U.S. intelligence by...
And had been called that before all
right.
of this.
Right, yeah. Yes, uh-huh. And he was directed to U.S. intelligence by German intelligence. Now, the really interesting thing here is that nobody from any U.S. intelligence agency actually talked to the guy. Nobody interviewed him. Nobody actually met the guy. They just got the information from German intelligence. And German intelligence agents have told the British press and the other European press that they sent that information over with a caveat. They said, look, we think this guy isn't real. We don't think what he's saying is actually true, but here's the information anyway. So the Bush administration took something that came with a major caveat that it probably isn't true, and they made this huge presentation out of it. Now, the guy that this defector... There's another little interesting aspect to this story, too. He's referred to by the Germans as his code name is Curveball.
Which I think is hilarious.
Yeah, which is hilarious because he certainly threw a curveball. But
I was thinking it's the Bush administration threw a curveball to us.
Yeah, that's true, too. But it turns out that this guy is the brother of a top aide of Ahmed Chalabi. So he has a direct relationship to Chalabi, this guy who you probably heard his name on this program before.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laughing, but I had not actually heard that before. That's amazing.
No, that is true. He is the brother of a top aide of Ahmed Chalabi. Now, folks might remember.
They don't even go very far to find these people, do
they?
No,
they don't. And folks might remember that we've talked about how Chalabi is on the Pentagon's payroll to find and in this case fabricate evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and this is just another evidence of it.
Yeah, it was a
large part of Colin Powell's presentation.
Yeah,
to the UN.
I've got a sister. She's in the inner circle of Saddam Hussein. You might want to talk with her.
Right. So another topic I want to talk about on this week in Iraq is oil exports from Iraq. Now we hear about rising gas prices and a shortage of oil, et cetera. Oil exports from Iraq have come to almost a virtual standstill. In the north, rising water levels in Kirkuk and continuing sabotage of the northern oil pipeline from northern Iraq to Turkey have pretty much closed down any shipments out of the port of Ceyhan. Excuse me. In the south, and this is more astonishing, in the south, which has been exporting oil for many months now, it's almost come to a standstill as well because international shipping firms are worried about the state of the infrastructure in the southern ports because of the over a decade of UN sanctions kept routine maintenance from happening on a lot of these facilities. And so there's some safety issues involved there. And then I learned this week, too, that the main export pipeline from the city of Basra down to the Fah Peninsula in the south of the country is on fire now. So
and this is happening while the Seattle Times has a headline this week. I believe it was on the front page saying something like Iraqi economy unshackled after the fall of Saddam, talking about how entrepreneurs are able to make vast sums of money in the new booming economy that is Iraq. I mean, it's such blatant propaganda.
Yeah, it's amazing. And so Iraqi oil exports are
entrepreneurs
down to,
because there's 80% unemployment. Nobody has a job. So
Iraqi oil exports are down to almost nothing. And this is also a major problem for Iraq because it's supposed to be their main source of dollars, of hard currency to help revive their economy is supposed to be coming from the oil exports. Folks might remember, too, that the company that's in charge of modernizing the oil infrastructure is Halliburton, and Halliburton is currently under investigation by the Pentagon, and Congress may also get in on this, and the Justice Department has also begun to get in on the investigation, too, for taking large sums of money and performing very little work in return. Now, there's another bit of news coming out of Iraq this week. It turns out that Iraq will have a new dictator in July as part of the U.S. government's plans for a transition to democracy. Now, the U.S. authority has decided that it will not turn over the reins of government to an expanded governing council, and that's for obvious reasons. Folks will remember that the current council has been largely ineffective in reaching agreements on just about every aspect of the transition process, that Paul Bremer has alternately had to lead him by the nose and drive him with a stick just to sign an interim constitution that's still an incomplete document.
And that's extremely unpopular within Iraq itself.
Right. And so the governing council is not going to be expanded and take over the reins of government. The search is on now for Saddam's replacement, who coalition officials are hoping will be a Shiite, but it may not be, because the main criteria for this new dictator is that he be a quote-unquote technocrat. And you and I both know what that means. That means somebody who will rack up a huge national debt, sell off everything of value, and then take all that money and line his pockets and the pockets of all his friends and family. Sort of like George W. Bush.
Yeah, and one of the other one of the other criteria for a technocrat is somebody who has experience in administration, and of course that is either going to mean somebody who is in exile or somebody who helped run Iraq sometime during the last 35 years.
Yeah, somebody who came right out of the Saddam Hussein administration.
Yes, and who is very likely, therefore, to be a Sunni, as were most of the people under Saddam Hussein in his administration.
Yeah, so it might not be a Shiite. However, if they insist that it has to be a Shiite, there is one guy who qualifies, who's in Iraq right now, and that is our friend Ahmed Chalabi. Now, the last thing I want to talk about for this week in Iraq is the headline-grabbing story this week was the four Americans who were killed in Fallujah and whose bodies were mutilated and hung from a bridge, etc. I want to make a couple of points about that. In the first reports and even in later reports that I've seen, these guys were called civilian contractors. That is not true. These guys were military contractors. They worked for a private security firm and they were performing the job that U.S. troops would be performing. They were escorting a truck that was delivering food to a U.S. air base that's near Fallujah. Now, this is something that the U.S. media doesn't talk about a whole lot and that the Bush administration doesn't talk about at all. The fact that Rumsfeld overruled the advice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other senior advisors at the Pentagon, and instead of sending 500,000 U.S. troops to Iraq, he sent about 100,000 to 150,000 troops and said that we'll make up the difference with private security firms. And that's something that isn't talked about at all in the U.S. media, that these guys should have been U.S. troops, but instead they were military contractors.
And an awful lot of those private security firms and people in the private security firms wind up being mercenaries who are not U.S. citizens but are coming from all over the world.
That's right. In this case, it was U.S. citizens, but that's not always the case. It's often South Africans, Russians, people from all over the world who work for these private security companies. Now, there was also something else that the press neglected to mention, is that in Fallujah, in the weeks leading up to this incident, the U.S. Marines were taking over from an Army division the security situation in Fallujah. And the U.S. Marines were undergoing this major operation where they were doing nightly house-to-house searches.
I talked about that a little bit last week.
Right. And last week there was this major gun battle in the center of the city where a number of Iraqi civilians were killed, including an 11-year-old boy and an ABC News cameraman. And so there was a lot of anger building up to this whole incident. Now, there's also some other things that weren't discussed, too, about this whole incident. One of them is nobody really pointed out until after the incident occurred, and we're only hearing about it now in the media, that there are some questions about the training and the equipping of these private security people who are basically picking up the slack in Iraq. Now, these guys who were attacked in Fallujah, they were driving sport utility vehicles through the most dangerous area of the whole country. They were not in armored vehicles. They had weapons in their van, but they did not have them in their hands at the time of the attack. When they were ambushed, it was with small arms fire. Their vehicles were shot up and then later set on fire. So there's some question about why this whole notion that we should privatize the military, we should use these private security firms who don't have adequate training and obviously don't have adequate equipment. We're putting them in the line of fire. So these guys we really should look at their deaths as something that you can lay at the feet of someone like Donald Rumsfeld and George W. Bush.
Yeah. I wanted to make another observation about that, too, and particularly if you listen to right-wing radio or some of the commentators this week who are talking about the barbarians in Iraq and how could they possibly do something so uncivilized and so forth. You know, war is an ugly thing, and what we have in Iraq right now is a war on both sides. We have had a number of incidents in Iraq over the past number of months, and they are ongoing, where the U.S. military has been treating Iraqi civilians in a way that is just as abhorrent, just as repulsive to Iraqis as what happened this past week struck a lot of Americans as, where you have Iraqi civilians who are shot up at checkpoints or wherever it might be by by the U.S. military, and then just their bodies are left in the street. They're not attended to.
The local residents have to clean up the mess.
Yeah, the local residents have to clean up the blood, the brains that are splattered in the street by U.S. military.
And it's the same with suicide bombings as well. The U.S. military comes in, sees if there are any Americans involved, and if they're not, they move off and they leave the local residents to clean up the mess.
And so what you wind up with, and bear in mind that the U.S. military in this case is also supposed to be the government that is ruling the country. They're not just there to look after Americans. They're there to look after everybody because
supposedly
they're the only government that's in place. They threw out the government that was there.
Yeah.
So what you have is, particularly when you have an Islamic code that demands that people who are killed in such a manner be buried very, very quickly, and that their bodies be treated in a particular and in a respectful manner, it really is seen as a provocation and is extremely uncivilized and barbaric that the U.S. Has such a vastly different standard for how it treats American deaths from how it treats the deaths of Iraqi civilians. So it's not terribly surprising that you have that kind of anger built up toward the bodies of American civilians.
And a final note on the company that these military contractors came from. It's Blackwater USA, a relatively new company, started in 98. And one of the articles I saw recently on them said that they were hiring a lot of ex-military guys out of Chile and using them to guard, like, oil fields and stuff there.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I just want a couple little statistics about private security firms in Iraq. Nobody really knows how many private security troops are in Iraq. They estimate between 15 to 20,000. The Pentagon does not keep account. The Pentagon also does not keep account of the number of dead private security personnel, although some have said it's around 30. It may be higher. And then finally, the one thing the Pentagon does count is they count how much money they pay to private security firms. About $20 billion, that's about a third of what the Pentagon is spending on its troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, is allocated for private security personnel who make somewhere around six-figure salaries. Some of these guys make about $1,000 a day, which is far more than you would pay U.S. troops.
All right, let's move along. Job, our Vice President Cheney apparently is going to have a judge intervene on some things.
Yeah, I mean, this is an administration that likes to play "We've Got a Secret" pretty much every day, and they're getting in trouble for it. There was a federal district judge this week who ruled in one of the three different lawsuits that has been winding its way through the courts around Vice President Cheney's energy committee that came together in the first months of the administration in 2001 and devised the administration's energy policy. A lot of different environmental groups then promptly went to court because the administration had been saying that under the SHIELD laws that protect the president and vice president's offices from freedom of information and disclosure requirements, that the White House didn't have to say who they consulted with when making these energy policies, and has been talked about in a lot of places, including on this program over the past 3 years. It was believed that an awful lot of energy company executives were pretty much being given their wish lists. I mean, Kenneth Lay from Enron was a prominent figure in the early days of the administration, and obviously Cheney himself was fresh off his stint at Halliburton when he became a candidate for vice president. So you've had these three different lawsuits wending their way through the courts. The General Accounting Office filed suit against the White House, which is the first time that had ever happened. They lost in early rounds against the White House, and their suit has dropped by the wayside, but there are two that still survive. The Sierra Club has a suit that is now standing before the Supreme Court. And then there's this third lawsuit that the NRDC, the National Resources Defense Council, had going against the vice president's office, and that's the one that was ruled upon this week, saying that the vice president's office is required to release the records because there were people from the Interior Department that were also involved in the meeting, that they were required to list who was at the meetings, what was said at the meetings, what the advice was, where the advice came from, and how that played in the final document. The administration has until June to release these documents, and we'll see whether they do or not. Obviously, so far, the White House has been fighting tooth and nail to have to avoid releasing this, and if it would be terribly ironic if they had been fighting it for so long that the information finally came out right in the middle of the presidential campaign, because it would get that much more attention, and it deserves to have that much more attention. Just how much our natural resources in this country have been put up for sale by the Bush administration.
All right, and briefly, Maria, there was an article in The Independent this week about an FBI analyst that doesn't seem to be getting any coverage here in the U.S.
Yeah, yesterday The Independent reported that they had talked to an FBI translator, a woman who was hired by the FBI 2 days after September 11th to help go through, along with other translators, to help go through some of the intelligence intercepts up to September 11th and see where they had failed to foresee this attack by Al-Qaeda. And she has told the 9/11 commission, and she has now told The Independent, that she gave documents and information to the 9/11 commission that showed that the Bush administration had a ton of information. They had adequate information showing that Al-Qaeda was planning an attack with airplanes, planning to use them as missiles against skyscrapers in a number of cities in the U.S.
In the U.S.
And that it was imminent that the Al-Qaeda agents were in place and that it would happen within a matter of months. And that information is something that the Bush administration doesn't want to leak out. They've been trying to get a gag order against this person, and now she's being interviewed by the British press. It would be awfully nice to see her being interviewed by the U.S. press, although that hasn't happened yet.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. Jav, a couple events coming up this week you want to mention?
Yeah, we have Jim McDermott doing town hall meetings in Seattle this weekend, both today and tomorrow from 2:30 to 4 o'clock. Today it's at the Casey Family Program Center. That's at 23rd and Union in the Central District. And then tomorrow from 2:30 to 4 o'clock at the Southern Heights Elementary School. That's 11249 14th Avenue South. And then an old friend of mine, Charlie King, who I first met when he was in town doing a benefit concert for one or another activist group in Texas like 20 years ago. And he comes through town every couple, 3 years. He's from New England. But he and a woman who I don't know, is probably good just because she's with him, Karen Brandau, I'm sorry, they will be tonight at the University Unitarian Church up in View Ridge at 35th and 65th, I believe, Northeast in Seattle. So go and check them out. $14 at the door, $12 in advance for the tickets.
All right. Well, we're talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people, where do they find Eat the State?
You find it, it comes out every couple of weeks, a newspaper with local as well as global information and humor and research and lots of opinion. You can find it at places where you find free newspapers around town, bookstores and cafes and whatnot. Also on the web. Am I boring you, Mike?
I'm just really tired. It's really nothing personal, Jav.
You can also find it on the web, past issues as well as the current one at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have tips, comments, you have feedback on what you hear on the program, you'd like to volunteer, give donations, anything like that, tips for staying awake, whatever it might be.
You'd like to give evidence on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, although we're not paying like the
That's
Pentagon.
Right. But if you have a sister who's been close to Saddam Hussein, you know, we'd like to find out about these things. It's our voicemail, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, area code 206-903-9461.